everybody. It's John Marks, the editor of CopsAlive.com. I want to welcome you to another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. Today, we're going to be talking about a couple of tough subjects. We're going to talk about on-the-job injuries. We're going to talk about coping with PTSD. And bottom line, we're going to talk about, you know, coping with the job and the after effects of the job. I'm going to introduce our guest this morning. He's asked not to share his identity, so I'm just going to call him M. M worked for a mid-sized Eastern United States Police Department, had an interesting career, and had some interesting side effects. M, I want to thank you for being with us. Why don't you share your story with us?
Okay. Well, I began my career in 2001, just prior to 9/11. I was hired by a small department after graduating the academy and did a year there to basically directing traffic. Then I went on to be hired by a larger police department in my area back in 2003. And for the most part, my career was no different than anyone else's. You know, you go to your calls, you know, you leave the shift and then you try to forget you were there that day. But, you know, over the time I was there, my shift handled about 75,000 calls per year, and really it only seemed like there was maybe 5 to 8 of us taking those calls. So it's been a lot of calls over the years and a lot of stress in that time frame.
Yeah. The size of your agency is probably about average in the United States and maybe larger than some others. You know, I'm getting the impression from our talking that it isn't so much about the career path as sort of the way things ended and what you figured out when the job was over. How do you want to tell your story?
I just think it starts from the time of the accident. You know, basically in December of 2003, I was involved in a motor vehicle accident on a DUI. My accident was in a DUI-related accident. Trying to get the cars off the roadway when I was struck by a vehicle in the kneecap area and ended up riding the hood of the car for, you know, a couple hundred feet before the guy threw the car in park and ended up on railroad tracks. And oddly enough, I remember right after I, you know, got trying to get off the ground, the cops that I knew had run over. And I remember thinking to myself, this is the first time I have a holiday off in probably 6 years. And I don't know why that was a relief to me, but then I started to realize how much the stress had gotten to me. Getting hit by a car was actually a vacation from that job. You know, that was the first time I'd actually really felt almost relieved to be injured.
That's kind of sad, actually.
Yeah, it is.
So you're injured on the job, and what happened?
Well, I mean, I went through the same process everyone else does. You go to the hospital, they release you. You get contacted by a city nurse. They basically tell you to show up for a doctor's appointment, at which time they tell you, oh, you'll be back on your feet in no time. And meanwhile, your legs are all shattered. You know, that goes to another point. I mean, you get injured and you get, you know, less than reliable medical care sometimes, you know. My accident, I didn't even find out my legs were broken until 3 weeks after when I got a call from a doctor I didn't even know telling me to get to emergency room. Some of my other buddies had gotten broken ribs from car accidents and had passed out in the parking lot of the hospital. I mean, just really substandard medical care, as well as the doctors they send you to.
Yeah.
You know, for me, going to their doctors was basically like getting kicked in the stomach because every time you go, they try to belittle everything you say. You know, oh, my legs hurt. Oh, but they hurt less than before.
Right.
No, you've said that. You know, they constantly try to make you out to be better than you are so that they can push you off a system that's flawed.
Mm.
It's inherently flawed. Their goal isn't to make you better. Their goal is to get you either A, back to a job and managing through pain, whether it be on pain meds or alcohol, or their mission is to make your life so difficult that you end up either killing yourself or quitting.
Mm.
I mean, that's been my experience with Heart and Lung and these insurance agents.
Yeah.
It's a terrible road dealing with those people. And they really make life difficult. I've had them let air out of my tires and wait for me to go out there to put air in there to try to snap a photo of me doing normal things like taking out the garbage or going down to get groceries that everybody has to do. I mean, you know, it's just a terrible, terrible road. They really put the screws to you. You know, it makes your life very difficult after an accident. And then little things like going out and severing your lifestyle, you know, not going out with your friends because you're bedridden. That stuff kind of catches up to you, too.
Yeah. How did you find out you weren't going to get back on the job?
The way I found out was I got a call from a neurologist that I was seeing after the accident, and he indicated that I had tested it short of irregular, and he believed I had epilepsy. And, of course, I had never fallen. To this day, I've never fallen, hit the ground, and had a seizure like you'd expect.
Right.
Mine were different. I would have numbing of the lips. I'd get real confused, and then I'd get pissed off. And it was always the same. No matter, I'd be in a line somewhere, and I could feel it coming on. And I would literally just leave my stuff right there and just get out of the store because I didn't want to be around people at that point because I was afraid of what I might do.
And so the diagnosis kept you from going back?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I kept a lot of that to myself. And, you know, I found out, they basically said off the record, I said, is there anywhere else down the food chain for me here? And they said, absolutely not. They didn't give me anything to work with. So I knew my career was over at that moment.
Well, the other thing, when you and I talked, we talked about the injury, but also just some of the effects of PTSD that you described. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. Mine started out early on. I'd say maybe after the first year, I started noticing the symptoms. For me, it started out with drinking, hanging out with guys that had gotten back from overseas, you know, living the high-risk lifestyle that these guys were living, you know, basically having sex with you know, copious amounts of women, you know, just doing dumb things when I was off duty, you know, urinating in public, you know, when after I'm drinking, you know, write my name on a wall or something. You know, things that I thought were amusing that actually were not very funny after the fact that ended up causing me some grief. You know, breaking up bar fights, doing anything to still stay in the game after the accident, you know, things like that. Just basically looking for problems to try to resolve. Yeah. You know, breaking up domestic disturbances in the neighborhood here. You know, stuff like that, it really, you know, at the time appeared to be funny to other people, but it was really self-destructive behavior on my behalf.
Well, I think you even told me your agency was one of those that requires you to live within the city limits so that you really couldn't even get away from it.
That's right. Now, that was the hardest part of being here is, you know, the constant reminder that you're not on the job, the constant reminder of the job, the constant run-ins with people that have been arrested or remember you from it, co-workers, things like that. There's no way to escape it. And even the guys that are here that are still working, they're always trying to get out of this. They're trying to move away. They're just anything to get away. You can't, you know, you go to a bar or a grocery store and you're liable to get stabbed by somebody that just got out of prison that remembers you from something. You know, you really can't hide here. You're very, very transparent. And then if you get in trouble for something or basically you're not you. You're the department, so you directly represent everything here. So there's really no way to vent or get away from any of this. It's in your life 24 hours a day.
Yeah, from our discussions, it sounds like the job really took its toll on you even before the accident, and you just sort of became aware of it afterwards.
For me, the accident actually opened my eyes toward how big the problem had gotten because even before this, I had days where I felt suicidal. I would go drinking and come home, and I'd be outside, and then I'd get pissed if I thought about it, and then I'd want to go and take out 10 more people because I thought that's the better way to go out is to, you know, maybe bring some scumbags with me, for lack of a better word. But, you know, then I started to think about it, maybe largely because I was probably sobering up, but you know, this happened quite a bit over the years, maybe five times. One time I had a fellow cop with me that you know, fortunately was able to talk some sense in me and make me realize how far I had gotten from normal at that point. And then I found out over the years that there's been a lot of incidents that have been buried by our department where cops have tried to off themselves, and instead of getting 302'd, which is what we call it, they basically get they'll have to admit themselves for care, and then you know basically they don't get their gun stripped from them. They come back to work. I mean, the mental illness here, the types of suicide that we deal with, it gets buried, and you know, people will make fun of you. You say something to somebody the wrong way, you know, you get in a fight with another cop, and they're like, yeah, go blow your head off, you know, like, things like that. You know, I know one guy in particular, his wife left him, and he came home, and all of her stuff was gone, and the guy sat on his front porch, basically, you know, on the verge of killing himself, and two or three of the guys I work with had gone over there to you know, intercede, you know, and basically they helped him out, you know, by getting him the help he needed. And he's, you know, been a good cop. He's almost ready to retire now. But the truth be told, somebody like that should have been off a while. They should have been forced to really go get better help than they've been, you know. Burying it doesn't do these guys any service. It helps them, it enables them to become, to get closer to actually killing themselves in a lot of cases, I think.
Yeah. You know, what I was surprised about is you told me when you actually realized you needed some help and started to reach out, it was really hard to find help.
Oh, absolutely. I when I knew I needed help, I placed no fewer than 10 calls, you know, out of the yellow books here. Even to some people, when I had had my MMPI, when I had started the job, I even had the card from the lady that administered that, and I contacted her office. And at each one of these places, I left a detailed voice message indicating that I, you know, I would like to seek counseling for work-related stresses, you know, from law enforcement. And out of all the calls I placed, I only got one call back from a guy in New York. And he ended up being a tremendous help to me in the support structure in my life, because what he taught me was we tend, you know, as law enforcement, to look at the negative in everything we do. He said, think about a negative situation that you encountered, and now think about the positive outcome that occurred as a result of you being there rather than the stuff that you saw or had to deal with. Because when you consider the end result, if you hadn't been there, the end result would have been negative all the way around, whereas you probably affected change in someone else's life. And until that point, I hadn't considered anything good out of everything. You know, you go to a child neglect call, you don't consider that you took the kid away from the parents. All you see is the neglect that you'd witnessed when you were on scene of a crime like that, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, it kind of sounds to me, and I've talked to you a little longer than what we're doing on the air here, but it sounds to me like, you know, you've really come to grips with what happened and have really processed an awful lot since your accident.
You know, I'm going to compare it to smoking. I had a guy one time, an old guy, I was having a cigarette years ago, and he said to me, oh, you know, I smoked for a number of years. I said, well, did you ever miss it? He said, every single day I think about having a cigarette. And every single day, I have to tell myself no. But this, when you come to terms with something's one thing. It's a daily struggle. You have to constantly be aware of how you feel, what you're doing is affecting other people. You have to be very, very, you know, cognizant of everything, because you don't just get better from something. It's very much a lifestyle decision. It's like a diet. You have to modify everything you do to try to be healthier than what you were before. And for me, you know, when I find myself going down a darker path or something, I know that there's, you know, I know I have to adjust my lifestyle or whatever I'm doing so that I feel better and healthier about everything. So it's, you know, something like this, you have to live with it, and you have to find ways of coping. And it's, you know, it's very easy to give up at times.
Yeah.
And you know, what I would suggest is, you know, it doesn't hurt to talk to people.
Yeah, I asked earlier if your department had any kind of peer support, and what was your answer?
No. The local bar.
Yeah,
we have a thing in our department, the bar and the church. You've got guys that go hyper-religious, they don't drink, they go to church every day, you know, and then you got the guys that go out and get liquored up and pretty much stop giving a shit. And I think most of the department, excuse my French, falls under that first category. And the interesting thing is, when we go to a bar, and I don't know how other departments are, we don't necessarily sit next to each other. We'll probably sit across from each other. We'll probably say hi, but that's the extent of the conversation. We don't like to sit by each other because we don't like to talk about work. And really, for us, it's an outlet, but at the same time, it's not a very healthy one.
Yeah. You know, I've always thought that one of the biggest side effects of law enforcement that I think takes place early on is anger. We get frustrated. I think that the core of burnout is anger and frustration. And it seems to me that that takes its toll on a lot of cops. And they turn, like you said, they turn to religion and they turn to drinking or whatever other high risk behavior they choose to try to quell that.
Absolutely. I mean, and violence too. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when I took the job, I was new, I was naive, you see in the paper and you kind of have an idea of what to expect in life when you go out there, but you don't expect to have to deal with the type of people that are out there. I remember, I think I was probably in a job maybe 4 months. I was still just getting off FTO at that point, and I saw this guy, and basically a bunch of cops were on him. They could have probably cuffed him relatively easily, but I thought they took a few liberties that they shouldn't have, and I said something at the time. I said, that this seemed a little excessive to me. And, you get the look, the rolled eyes, like basically shut up, and that stuck with me. I thought you shouldn't have to treat people like this. But then after a while, especially working on the wagon like I did for as long as I did, you start to really, really hate people. You literally look at everybody like they're a junkie or a scumbag. As a matter of fact, to this day, I can't sit with my back to people. I have to have my back against the wall when I eat. I literally can't be facing, I can't have my back to a door or people, or I don't feel comfortable enough to be there.
Yeah.
You just learn how to really, really pick apart people. I mean, you meet somebody, the first thing you're thinking of is, what crime is this guy likely to commit? You're trying to always weigh people for the negative that they possess instead of going through life like you did before where you look at everybody like, benefit of the doubt, this guy's a nice guy, and you get to know him, and then you find out he's an asshole, We don't have that luxury.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say that good news to this story is that despite all that's happened to you, I already know that you've actually really turned things around. You've really made something of your life. You've changed things. What have you learned from all of this, and what do you want to share with everybody that's listening?
What I've learned is when you feel it, when you're your lowest, when you think that things can't get worse, they generally can't. But you need to be the change in your own life that you want to see. I mean, for myself, when I was working, I didn't have the time to go back and finish degrees. So the first thing I did to keep myself busy so I wouldn't be constantly dwelling on the job and everything was to go back and finish my degrees. And, basically start a new life. I wanted a plan B in case plan A didn't pan out for me any longer. A lot of guys won't do that. They'll wait to the last minute. They'll wait until they know it's over. And by then, you're already behind a year or two.
Yep.
I would say that, don't let yourself dwell in your problems. Try to find something constructive to do outside of law enforcement to keep yourself occupied. If it means going back to school, then do it. But don't allow yourself the time to sit alone, because that's when you really start having a lot more problems.
And, you also talked about the, I guess, psychologist from New York that you connected with. How's that going? How'd that help?
Right now I fall into a unique situation without health care, because when I retired, they stripped that from me pretty quickly. So I don't have the luxury of seeing the psychologist anymore. But the stuff I learned from him, I definitely think it's carried me a long way. And I know right now that there's times where if you I can reflect back upon the conversations I had with him and really draw some strength from that time I spent. But a lot of cops won't be fortunate enough to get somebody that really cared. Yeah. I mean, most of the people you go and see, they'll listen to you, but they're not really listening. They're looking at a clock. They think we have an hour here, only 59 minutes. I mean, this individual actually asked questions, didn't push too hard. The worst thing you want to do is push. And I found that our conversations, I go there 2-3 times a week. We talk about something relevant maybe once every 6 visits. Most of the time we talked about nothing at all.
Mm-hmm.
But what was seemingly nothing was letting me speak about things that bothered me when I was ready to talk about them without trying to press for it, because it had to fit in the constraints of the time we had together. And you'd be surprised. For me, that's when I realized my PTSD rather wasn't from one critical incident that it went south, or one horrible crime scene. It was from a career of small calls. Child neglect, child rape, bodies, car accidents, suicides, I mean, drug activity, prostitution, alcoholics, you name it, I've seen it. And it's been right in my face all the time. That stuff, I look at it like a poison. If you have it in moderation like the normal person does, it doesn't bother you. Maybe it makes you upset, you know, maybe a little sick to your stomach to see once or twice if you have it. But when you take that little dose of poison every single day, eventually you end up very sick, and there's nothing you can do about it other than step away from it and try to recapture what life you have and find joy in it.
I wanted to back you up for a second and talk about the insurance issues. I think that's important. I think most people sort of expect it. First of all, most cops I've talked to never expect they're going to get injured on the job, and yet more officers are injured and killed than anything else. And I think they expect if I get injured, I'm going to get taken care of, and that isn't necessarily the case. What happened with insurance? It just went away, right?
Yeah, for me, what happened was, it was actually interesting because when I took this job, it was under the thought that, yeah, you get injured. Like, well, I was in the military years earlier, but you get hurt, in the military, at the VA hospital fall back on. With this, when I got hurt, they told me, if you retire before this date, you'll have health care for life. And, of course, I jumped right on that. I'm like, yeah, great. Now, my advice to everybody is get everything in writing. Never take anyone's word for anything. That's the most important thing there with health care. Don't let somebody tell you you're going to get it. Have them write it down.
Yeah.
For me, what happened was I fell into a new contract. Basically, when there was a group of people that had retired before I had come on, and they had given away our health care. They had negotiated it away in order to get a fat check, one-time payout for themselves. And they had, of course, health care for life. And it caused dissension amongst our union, really a rift where we actually hate a lot of the retired guys because of it. The problem I run into is I'm one of the first ones that retired under this new contract. So these guys that are still working don't know that if they get hit or get paralyzed or shot or even killed, their family doesn't get health care. It disappears. If you go to work one day and you get shot and killed, your wife and kids that are on your plan are gone. They're off the plan. They are not covered any longer by your plan. And then there comes in the nightmare of getting private health care insurance when you get injured. For me, I found that immediately once people found out what I did for a living, they come up with a term called pre-existing condition. That's their way of saying, we're not going to insure you. So for me, I couldn't get private health care. I applied to, I don't know, 5 or 7 different agencies. I even applied to one of these online ones where they can shop it for you and try to get you a good rate. And basically, I found that they want you to pay in $10,000 before they cover anything, and then they only cover so much anyways. They really find a way to put the screws to you so you can't even get health care anymore.
Well, and the other thing I think I heard you say earlier is there's kind of a big difference between, an injury that is a major disability and some of the injuries that keep you from going back to the job, but, don't ruin your life. And so there you are feeling like, I should be able to do something, and yet you can't be insured.
For me, I mean, I got the knee injuries and the back injuries, but I'm fortunate. I know people that are hurt a lot worse than me. My injury hurts, right around winter time when it starts to snow. But I mean, I'm seemingly normal looking from the outside. I mean, you wouldn't know other than maybe a couple little scars that I had, the surgeries I've had, and I walk around and I'm able to lift weights and garbage and stuff like that. I'm even at times able to do the old job again. Minus having one of the handcuffs where they were at. But the whole point is, as good as I feel some days, I'm in better shape than most of the people around me. But I can't get health care, and they do.
Yeah.
It's almost like you're being discriminated against when you go to apply for it.
Yeah. Well, by the nature of our career, we are more prone to lots of illnesses and injuries. I'm sure that the insurance companies don't want to deal with us.
No. I mean, I think they have a rating scale because it literally – one company, this is supposed to show you how discriminatory they are. I had insurance, private health care I got fortunate through a company. Then I went to work for another company and went on the corporate policy. And when I left, I went to look at the same plan. Now, it had been years since the accident, and it had been 1 year since I had that private plan to the same company. Now, I had not been to the hospital once in that year for anything, not even a chiropractic adjustment. And I got declined because they pulled up stuff from years earlier that hadn't been an issue the first go around, you know, that they thought would preclude me from being insurable. And then they don't call you back. What they try to do is get you to give up. And I think that's one of the big things that people will find when they're injured is people want you to quit. They're going to make it as difficult as they can for you, hoping you'll quit. And that you can't give up no matter what they do, no matter what happens. You got to be persistent. You got to be very, very annoying, almost to the point where you annoy yourself. Because the only way you get something done is by keeping in these people's faces. You have to be a nightmare for them.
Let me ask you two questions. What would you say to the people that are on the job now? And secondly, what advice do you have for people who are just starting their jobs, just starting their careers?
Well, people that are on a job now, I'd say buy a secondary health care coverage. They have a plan out there. It subsidizes your income if you get injured. Heart and lung is a beautiful thing. I mean, in reality, it does pay us more money, and it's tax exempt. But there's things that are going to come up, driving to these doctor's appointments, having to hire people to take you from A to B. And they'll tell you, yeah, that's covered, but getting money from the insurance company is very difficult at times. Have that supplemental insurance, buy it immediately. Always have an exit strategy. I tell people this all the time. Don't go around thinking you're impervious, you're RoboCop, or you're bulletproof. Have an exit strategy. Have a plan B. Plan to leave. Plan to leave in 30 years. Plan to leave in 5 years. Have a plan that is adjustable so that when the time comes, you're not taken off guard, you know, and you'll be able to deal with it a little more effectively than I did. I kind of wore blinders through my career. I didn't think I'd ever get injured. I wasn't naive, but I was also very careful, you know.
Yeah.
I always had my head on a swivel, always aware of the situations, but things happen, and you know, that's why they call them accidents, you know.
Well, and by plan B, you're talking about have your degree, have another vocation, have another business, have something you can do besides police work.
I look at the cops that live a good lifestyle when they retire. I look at the ones that die from a heart attack or a number of other illnesses that we're subjected to. The ones that are seemingly happy had a hobby. They had something that they enjoyed doing when they worked. They were able to turn into a profession. And I found that those people generally seem to be more stable than the people that say, well, I'm retiring next year and just retire. Then they say, well, okay, now I'll do something. You have to have something in mind. You have to have something to a goal in mind that will make the transition to civilian life easy, because I know too many people that they lose that authority, that lifestyle, and they find that they're just like everyone else, and there's no easy way to cope with it.
Yeah.
And you start feeling really, really, really depressed over that stuff. You know, especially when you see crime happen right in front of you and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yep. So what would you say to the new cadets, people that are just starting their career? How do they weather the toxicity of this job?
You know, I don't think there's anything that they can do. I think everybody's different. I think some people cope with it better. I think there needs to be reform to the way law enforcement is in general. I think our updates need to encompass mental health programs that are required every year. I think the only way to really help these new guys, these guys coming in, is to make them seek counseling from day one and keep up with it, just like they do any other training. Just, you know, you go to a class on recognizing special needs or how to deal with the elderly, but you don't go to a class on how to deal with the stresses of this job, and you don't have to see a professional, you know, to speak to the individual about even small things. I mean, think about the career as a backpack. You start out with an empty bag, and you put little weights in there, and after a while, you're carrying around this heavy bag full of a large amount of weight, seeking help from day one, even if it means going privately to go get it yourself. Go speak to somebody, even if it's about nothing, but keep up with it every year, every month if you have to. Don't let the bag build up so it's so heavy to carry that you feel like you can't lift it anymore and you have to quit.
I was going to say, you know,
help from day one.
A lot of people in law enforcement are really afraid of having annual mental health checkups. They think that they're just going to use that as a way to get them off the job.
Oh, absolutely. And more importantly, let's say you get a call where you're dealing with an individual is unruly and the guy's, you know, putting up a fight, and you detain this person, and now you're brought up by the individual, whether civilly or criminally, for excessive violence. You go to get you go in front of a jury and they say, hey, have you ever gotten counseling? Yes. Have you ever been to counseling for job-related stresses? Yes. All of a sudden, now they're painting the picture of this, person with mental defect that's a loose cannon. That's where the problem with our system lies. If it was mandatory, that argument would be irrelevant, and the nature of the conversation between you and your counselor would fall under a HIPAA guideline, which would be private. It wouldn't be admissible in court. Now, if you're going for private care, I don't know how that would work, but it would automatically, I think, make most cops look bad for seeking help for something. I think that the whole system needs to be reformed, and I think it should be mandatory, not just to save lives, but to protect people and their private, their lives from ridicule from a group of jurors or an overzealous attorney.
Yeah.
I mean, these are important things.
So what's next?
The system as a whole.
I was going to say, what's next in your life? What's positive happening for you?
Well, for me, I stopped dwelling in the past. I made the decision a while ago to bury law enforcement and put it as far behind me as I could. Taking the patches off the uniform, shredding the boxes of records, putting the photos out of sight, any statues of law enforcement stuff that I'd been given, gifts like that. I put it away because, for me, I want to focus on the now and not the then. I've been very fortunate. I started a new company for myself, and it deals with law enforcement. I'm still in the community. I'm just not going to ever, be the guy I was before. And I think, for me, that's the healthiest way to go about it. I mean, everybody's going to handle things differently. Some people are able to cope a little bit better. But for me, just not having a reminder seems to be a help at this point.
Yeah. Well, I want to say thanks for taking the time to share. I think your story strikes home to a lot of people. And my opinion is if there's just one thing that you said that help somebody out there, then it's all worth it. You have any final thoughts that you want to share?
My thought is keep fighting. Don't give up. Don't be afraid to seek help. And don't wait to seek help. Seek help immediately, even if you don't think there's something wrong with you. Because for me, if I had gone earlier, I think that I would have recognized the problems I had and had a healthier career. I waited far too long to get the help that I should have been getting probably the first year in. So don't wait to seek that help. Seek it whether you think you have a problem or not. It'll just make you a happier person, and you'll live a much healthier lifestyle.
Well, I want to say thanks again. I appreciate you taking the time. Cops Alive is about cops helping other cops survive this job. And one of the big problems is a lot of officers out there don't recognize what some of the threats are against them. They don't know what it is that's going to get them. Most people don't ever think they're going to get injured on the job. We train for a gunfight, but we don't ever train for, most agencies don't train for those kind of injuries. And I think I saw stats the other day that there are more disabled officers out there than there are even officers in the United States. And that's appalling, and yet nobody expects that's what's going to happen. So I appreciate you being honest and candid about your experiences, and I want to thank you for taking the time to share.
You're welcome, and if it helps even one person, it was worthwhile.
Thanks. And thank you all for listening. This has been another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. I want to thank you. I want to advise you to stay safe and stay well. And tune in next time for another edition of Audio Bulletin that might help you survive your career.